through these first three episodes, we're seeing a lot about family dynamics at the dinner table.
In terms of like things that maybe haven't aged well, why do we have to use this homophobic slur?
This is where we really go off the deep end into something totally different from anything else that had ever been on TV before.
Both Lynch and Cooper have a process that gets down to deep intuition.
Hello, and welcome to Back to the Double R, a podcast about Twin Peaks. My name is Damon.
Owen here.
Hi, I'm Jennifer.
I'm Jonathan.
So this is a podcast in which we analyze each episode of Twin Peaks, one episode at a time. And I want to just pause here to say happy birthday to co-creator of Twin Peaks, David Lynch, who at the time of this recording is about to celebrate his 75th birthday. Today, we are talking about my very favorite episode of Twin Peaks, perhaps my favorite episode of any television show ever. And this is episode 3, entitled Zen or The Skill to Catch a Killer.
All right. Again, we're going to start off with a brief recap of this monumental episode of television. It opens the next day in Twin Peaks, where the Horns are having dinner at the Great Northern. We meet Ben's brother, Jerry, and they together take a trip across the Canadian border to the casino / brothel One-Eyed Jack's. The next morning, the murder investigation continues when Agent Cooper introduces the team to an unconventional deductive technique. Elsewhere in Twin Peaks, Audrey dances, Leland dances, and FBI forensics expert Albert Rosenfield arrives and gets into a conflict with Sheriff Truman. In the evening, Cooper goes to sleep. He has a strange dream, and he wakens the next morning with the answer to the question, who killed Laura Palmer? This episode was originally broadcast on the ABC network on April 19th, 1990. It was written by David Lynch and Mark Frost and directed by David Lynch himself. One of the things we are going to do here on Back to the Double R from time to time is a section that we call like regrets, or if we have any sort of previous thoughts or things like that from the last episode that we maybe didn't touch on or want to briefly discuss before we get into the meat of this episode. And one thing I wanted to bring up was, I know Jennifer mentioned, or at least brought up, like the fact that, you know, some of the characters, especially maybe Audrey, kind of reminds them of Marilyn Monroe. When I was reading the reflections by Brad Dukes, The Oral History of Twin Peaks, he mentioned that a project that Lynch and Frost were originally going to collaborate on before they did Twin Peaks was an adaptation of her biography. So it's clear that, you know, Monroe is sort of in the back of their minds, and, you know, given the whole sort of 50s vibe of the show, that's completely unsurprising. Another completely unrelated to at least the plot of the show, but sort of amusing story nonetheless about Monroe is Monroe obviously was friends with all kinds of people in Hollywood. And one of her friends was the singer / actress Rosemary Clooney. And so at a party, I think it was maybe 1955, Monroe gets invited to Rosemary Clooney's house. And Rosemary Clooney had just had a baby at the time. So, you know, she goes upstairs, she sees the baby, you know, she picks her up, you know, baby's crying until the baby looks into her eyes, at which point the baby is completely silent and docile. And Monroe spends the rest of the party with the baby. And that baby is none other than Miguel Ferrer, who makes his introduction in this episode and goes on to play Albert Rosenfield. I know you guys look flabbergasted. Like I found that on IMDb trivia and like a couple other sections. So I don't know if it's like truth / urban legend, but I think a lot of those Hollywood stories kind of end up being that way. And I think it also sort of like we were talking about how sort of like, you know, small towns might have sort of like a inbred or interconnected nature. I think the same is true of Hollywood itself. So both things sort of tangentially tie into Twin Peaks.
I'm always interested in how episodes begin, and in this episode, episode 3, we start at the dinner table with the Horn family, and really for through these first three episodes, we're seeing a lot about family dynamics at the dinner table, and this is quite a different dinner table than in the prior episodes. The episode opens in the Horn household at a quietly awkward meal. It's shot from a distance. People are seated at the table far apart. And we're really only hearing the sounds of silverware and eating. and a slight humming from adult son, the adult son, Johnny, who is sort of rocking in his chair and is wearing a full headdress. And suddenly this quiet scene is changed when the doors burst open with the loud entrance of Ben's brother, Jerry, who's played by David Patrick Kelly, who was just interesting connections. David Patrick Kelly was a gang member in the film The Warriors, and Jerry bursts in back from Paris. He's wearing sunglasses. He breaks into this quietly awkward scene with all of his bluster, and his arrival changes the whole scene. He pulls out these baguette sandwiches wrapped in plastic, and he and his brother Ben Horn rhapsodize over them. Ben smells the sandwich, stuffs his face, and then excuses himself from the dinner table, saying, "Always a pleasure," before he leaves with his brother Jerry on a nighttime adventure. And those words to me say it all. Ben Horn, driven by pleasure, which we started to see glimpses of in last week's episode. And as the boys are sort of plotting, preparing for their nighttime adventure, Jerry says, "All work and no play makes Ben and Jerry dull boys." And there's this real boyish character to their relationship, especially to Jerry, where he just seems like a child. They get on a speedboat to a brothel associated with the One-Eyed Jack's casino across the border. And then Ben ultimately goes to a back room with a new girl who we're led to believe was plucked from the perfume counter of the Horn department store. So Ben Horn, played by George Richard Bamar, was in West Side Story. And so it's interesting that these two characters, these two brothers, were gang members in other films showing, you know, wild youth. And it's kind of the perfect, sort of the perfect backdrop to this scene where Ben Horn is pure id and gluttony this week. And you know, it's this very, you know, it's all about food and pleasure and carnal things. And a very appropriate follow-up to last week where we see Ben in this illicit affair that he's having. And so, you know, earlier when Ben arrives at the table, or when Jerry arrives at the table, Ben's wife looks repulsed, and Jerry sort of goes up to her and she starts screaming at her husband, you know, basically like, "Get this guy off of me." You know, he's just sort of leaning into her. And then later she covers her eyes and just looks mortified by the behavior of her husband. So, you know, this is just the start of an episode that is full of clues and layers. And this late night visit to One-Eyed Jack's takes place just as Cooper is getting a note slipped under his door that reads "Jack with one eye." And so clearly we need to keep tabs on this place and also on the perfume counter as we're getting clues about both places. So in this early part of the episode, when Cooper gets this note about Jack with one eye, he sniffs the note and smiles, which leads us to wonder if he recognizes the scent of the note writer. And, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, could it be Audrey Horn, perhaps? So this whole connection with the Horns. So I wanted to talk to all of you about this opening family meal. What did it reveal to you about the Horn family?
First of all, just as a little tangent, if you ever have one of those sandwiches in Paris, that is really to die for, right? The fact that they're just scarfing that down is very realistic. I was in Paris a couple of years ago, and I sought one of those out because of that scene. And Jerry's not wrong.
It's a baguette with brie.
And butter.
Yeah, those are really good.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, you can make that here, right? But with, you know, actual, you know, fresh French brie, it's incredible. But that's a little bit of a tangent. You know, what there are several things that really strike me about that scene. One, that relationship between Ben and Jerry, right? They obviously bring out like the youth in each other. Although I think it doesn't take much to bring that out for Jerry. He's just like still a teenager, right? Even though he's a grown man. And you can see that as soon as he comes into the room, because he's wearing this like very fashionable 90s attire. He's definitely like still keeping up with the youth. And then, of course, obviously, there's the relationship between Ben and his wife, which is, you know, very clearly not a good one. Just by looking at this scene, it's very clear that Ben would rather be hanging out with his brother than with his wife and kids. And then, you know, the other thing that really jumps out to me, and, you know, I think this is something that John flagged a couple episodes ago as the kind of thing that we want to talk about. And that's this headdress, right? Which is clearly not PC for a white person to be wearing, and rightly so. And this is something that would not pass in television today. But in context, it feels so 1990s Pacific Northwest, when there was all this sort of like lip service going on to honoring the Native heritage in that region that was actually very surface level and in a lot of ways very problematic.
Well, and, you know, in the hotel itself, you see a lot of like the, you know, the sort of Pacific Northwestern Native art, which is true to the region. And I mean, Johnny Horn in the long run of things is a pretty inconsequential character. So I'm not like, you know, too freaked out about it, but it's definitely one of those things you're like, okay, you know, if it was, you know, 30 years down the line, I think they'd probably handle both that and his sort of, like, I don't know if he's considered autistic. I think both things would be handled with a lot more sensitivity.
I think, you know, we've talked a lot about the 1950s and Twin Peaks. And it is also that scene and the image of him in the headdress makes me think of scenes from 1950s television shows where a boy might be wearing the attire of a Native American. Like, that was a sort of common 50s thing that little kids did. And Johnny is portrayed as somebody who has some sort of developmental challenges and is more childlike. And so that's kind of where I situated it, was that that's emphasizing the child in the man.
It is a nod to the 50s, and it's a nod to children's entertainment that centered on cowboys and Indians. So simple ideas of good and evil, you know, Sheriff Truman, a true man, is about as cowboy as you get. He even wears a stylized cowboy hat. You know, there's we have the character Hawk, who is important, not deeply developed so far, or much in the first season, if I recall. But that cowboys and Indians simplicity of the 50s is definitely invoked by the child trapped in a man's body, which of course is what Jerry and to a degree Ben are as well. That dinner table is the stuffy surface that suffocates Ben Horn, that he can't wait to leave, just gets up and leaves and goes off on his sensual pursuits with his brother. This episode is a lot about putting the lurid side of Twin Peaks cheek by jowl with the 1950s square and homey and idealized pictures as well.
And Colin, bouncing off that idea, Lynch intercuts that scene beginning with the horns at the dinner table with the scene with like the Haywards, right? Because Donna brings James home to meet her parents. And I mean, you can get two like more sort of, you know, visions of family, right? You have like one family who, I mean, it's funny, they eat where they work too. It's like they seem to live in the hotel, which I think is just, you know, very, very strange. But it's a long table, the R, like, you know, really fall apart. And then when you look at the Haywards, it's, you know, very tight knit, like Doc Hayward and his wife are engaging James and Donna. There's clearly like they all enjoy each other's company. When you see the other scene where it's like four people that like don't want to be in a room together whatsoever at all.
Yeah. And in this week's episode, we're seeing sort of the dessert scene at the Haywards where, you know, they're talking about church the next morning and Donna's offering to clean up so that her parents can go to bed. It's all very sweet, and they're all engaged with each other. Very, very different.
Right. There's That's exactly right. And there's tension there too, between the pretty surface and the carnal, because, you know, the kids obviously want to be left alone and the dad obviously doesn't want to leave them alone. You know, we're going to church bright and early, 9 o'clock. And then of course, you know, there is the sensual scene between James and Donna too, a very innocent form of carnal pleasure. So the next big moment in this episode is what we are calling the rocks and bottles section. This is where Cooper is using a deductive technique that he has developed to try and understand his intuition in analyzing the facts of the case. So he's going beyond his rational mind in this scene, but he's doing so in a very regimented way. So if you recall, there are actually two sections of the scene. The first setup where Cooper has Hawk holding a bucket of stones with oven mitts. He has Lucy putting a check mark by names with a J. He has Andy standing 60 feet and 6 inches, exactly 60 feet and 6 inches, the distance of a major league pitching slab to the to home plate. So Andy is standing beside the bottle, and he's introduced, Cooper has introduced this whole technique by saying he had a dream that showed him this technique in the context of the people of Tibet. He says he has the actual phrase is following a dream I had 3 years ago. I have become deeply moved by the plight of the Tibetan people and filled with a desire to help. So this is the way that he is going to get to what he calls the deepest level of intuition, mind and body coordinated with the deepest level of intuition. And so Sheriff Truman reads a name and we get a visual of the actors. This is a great mechanism for people to catch up in the story. The sort of, you know, if you have heard about Twin Peaks, but you are not yet watching it in 1990, then this is the way that we'll catch you up. So these main characters with the letter J. So Cooper, here's a name, here's the relationship to Laura Palmer, throws a rock. First couple don't hit, but we get a partial hit with Jacoby. So narratively, we know there's something going on. And it isn't until we get to Leo Johnson that Cooper's throw breaks the bottle. And, you know, up until this moment, there's been sort of this exuberant delight, you know, this excitement with everybody trying to figure out what Cooper's doing. And once the bottle is broken, this somberness comes over the party. And we are learning that Cooper is very disciplined, but he also has these techniques for seeing through things. We were saying last week, he has this rigorous methodology to see into the darkness. And there is a check here where Truman takes Cooper aside and said, "Did you really see this in a dream?" because the audience itself, we're probably wondering, is this true? Is this BS? Is this made up? What's going on? And I think at this point, we see Cooper as Lynch. Lynch, of course, is sort of famously devoted to transcendental meditation. He has a foundation to support it. He's brought a lot of people into that practice, and he has made it part of his artistic process. So both Lynch and Cooper have a process that gets down to deep intuition that may look odd to other people, but it leads to interesting places. So from this, we know that Cooper has special vision. This is related to him being hanging upside down in gravity boots at the start of the last episode. This is all part of his methodology. So I would put to you guys, just generally, like, what was your reaction to this? Did you think it was, did you think it was too arch, or did you think it felt natural for Cooper? I mean, at this point, we're still learning who Cooper is, but this is sort of so far out there. It feels like, oh man, this television show is so crazy. But of course, we haven't yet begun to see how crazy this really is. How did this strike you?
I'd like to jump in first. And, you know, before we get into the Cooper side of things, this is one of my favorite scenes in really the whole series.
Me too.
Just in the sense that, like, Lynch and Frost and the writers of the show do a consistently excellent job of finding artistic and interesting ways to do recap and foreshadowing, because not only does this, you know, show, you know, kind of really all we need to know about, you know, the previous two episodes, at least in terms of the investigation, but it also sets us up for the big dream sequence at the end of the episode. So, you know, these guys consistently do a lot of work in sort of educating the viewing audience on, like, you know, on, like, what's happened before and what's gonna come. So that's, I think, one thing that makes this sequence really brilliant. In terms of, like, you know, what I think it says about Cooper, one of the things that I really find great about Cooper is just, like, his openness, right? I think in your standard sort of police or detective show, you know, they would be laughing their butts off at some guy who's, like, throwing rocks at bottles to, you know, to try to come up with an answer for something. But, you know, and Cooper, and I think it even kind of extends to, like, some of the trust he's earned with, like, you know, Truman and Andy and Hawk and Lucy, that they're all really invested in it, and that, you know, they're along for the journey, right? He has an ability to really sort of bring people in. He's not someone that pushes people out.
That's right.
You know, it's about collaboration.
Well, and we see Lucy literally reading a book about Tibet later. Yep. So that totally verifies what you're saying, Jonathan. Like, she's all in.
When I used to teach a research methods class, I would show this scene. And I would ask the students to critique what Cooper's doing as an empirical method, right? And what they would come up with, which was what I would hope they would come up with, actually says a lot about Cooper, right? Because on the one hand, it's, you know, it's replicable. Anyone could follow these procedures. There are careful observations being made. You know, there's a very specific process that he has in mind. But at its core, it's based on something that is so wildly unscientific. Right. I mean, obviously, you know, whether this technique proves to be useful or not, I don't want to spoil it. It's certainly not anything that would be admissible in a court of law. So it's it really shows to me the sort of duality in Cooper's nature, right? That he's so precise and fastidious in some ways, and yet in other ways, he's on a completely different he's playing a different game from any of the other characters in the show, and certainly from any other detective on a detective show that I've ever seen.
And he's starting here with the J. So on the chalkboard, there's at least one other letter. So you're given the impression that this is the start, is we're going to go through the J names and we might see something else in the future. And back to the whole sensing, that he senses things differently. I've been thinking a lot about that in this episode because, as I mentioned, he senses something with smell when he gets this note about One-Eyed Jax, and he smells, he seems to know who sent the note based on smell, is my impression of that. And in an earlier episode, he picks up on somebody's affair based on body language. So he's using all sorts of senses, and we're starting, I guess they're getting revealed gradually, all these different heightened senses that Cooper has. And I think that's pretty interesting.
Here's a question. Do we need to see this scene to set up the dream sequence that's coming? Would it be just too much of a leap to go right into the Red Room?
I think so.
There is sort of this is a real world ritual that helps invite the Red Room into the show and into Cooper's psyche.
I just think that, you know, again, it's, you know, one of these scenes that one could stand on its own is just a nice little like scene that tells you a lot about Cooper, how characters react to him. But, you know, it really is Lynch and Frost sort of laying the tracks, right? Because my sort of big theme of the episode was the power of dreaming. And I myself am someone like, I don't really remember my dreams, right? So, you know, when you have someone like Cooper who is clearly in touch with the, you know, his subconscious and, you know, sort of his dreaming world, like it's nice to like give that power to people who maybe not necessarily have that own in their, you know, life. Like me, you know, I go to sleep, I don't like remember my dreams, I wake up the next day. But for other people, it's a huge part of their life. And it's nice that they like dramatized something so abstract in a very tangible way.
I'll say one last thing quickly about dreams. When I saw this episode, of course, you know, I was just finishing up college and had a whole lot of stuff to discover about the world. And I was like you, Jonathan, I didn't remember my dreams. And for the longest time, that was the case. I have recently come through an experience, actually taking care of my father, who was in the last year of his life. And it was so intense. And I never really relaxed, even when I slept. And what happened was, like, the door to my dream world got stuck open. And ever since then, I can remember my dreams. I can remember dreams I had months ago. There are vivid images that come to mind all the time. And it's like there is this open channel that wasn't there before. And so that gives some credibility to this technique that, you know, that I wouldn't have bought into before.
You know, that's really interesting, Colin, because, you know, sort of like associating that like emotionally intense experience with dreams, because I was doing a bit of research and the German word for dream is Traum, which, you know, shares an origin, you know, with trauma, right? And like, what else is Twin Peaks other than an examination of like great trauma and, you know, otherworldly dreams? I think, you know, it's a great scene. It does a lot of the legwork for, I mean, since it becomes so early in the show's run too, it's almost like a primer, right? Like, you know, you're going to get, you know, sort of this practical applications with, you know, otherworldly stuff happening in the future. Great, great scene. All right, folks, moving along to the next sort of section of Zen, or the skill to catch a serial killer. We're introduced to what I would consider to be a pretty major character in the Twin Peaks run. I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that Albert is going to be with us for quite a long time. But we meet Albert Rosenfield, who was alluded to in the previous episode. Albert is played by Miguel Ferrer, the late Miguel Ferrer. And one of the things that I'm going to bring up with Albert here is that me personally, I'm, you know, Mexican-American, a light-skinned Mexican-American. And Miguel Ferrer, he's an actor of Puerto Rican descent, and here he's playing a Jewish character. And there's kind of a long-standing tradition of you know, actors who have sort of like a fungible ethnicity, right? I'm thinking of guys like maybe like John Turturro, who has been, you know, called upon to play like Italians and Jewish men and all kinds of different characters. Or I was thinking too of like Clifton Collins, who I saw in a, I forget what I saw him in just recently, but I'm like, oh yeah, he's another one of those guys who's kind of like multi-ethnic. Or like Cliff Curtis, who's a Maori actor, tends to play like a lot of different types of, you know, things. So, you know, what do we think about like that practice in general? And, you know, if say we were going to redo the show, would it, you know, make a difference if say Albert was Puerto Rican instead of Jewish, just sort of match the heritage of the actor? You know, what's your, you know, feelings on that, guys? I'm going to throw the floor to you on that one.
It's an interesting question, and there is a lot of role playing in this show. There's a lot of stereotypes that we're playing with. We know that the Isabella Rossellini role of Josie Packard was recast to Joan Chen. And so, you know, broadly speaking, that is a long tradition in Hollywood. You're absolutely right. It has always been part of theater, from men playing women before women were allowed on the stage, going back centuries, and crisscrossing identities of actors with the roles that they play is something that is pretty modern. We would not necessarily think of it if we were an audience in the 50s. You know, there were a lot of there was a lot of red face in this Cowboys and Indians entertainment of the 1950s, following from the Cowboys and Indians movies of the 1930s and 40s. And this particular example of it is interesting. We don't hear much about Albert's Jewishness, and we might be making an assumption based on the name of the character, but I don't think we, if I recall, we don't get too deep into that whereas we could, we certainly could. So it's interesting, and it may just be that they had this role and they got Miguel Ferrer,
who's wonderful,
to
way.
Do it, which I would always cast Miguel Ferrer if I could.
Well, I was thinking about the Jewishness, and he does have a line in there where he asks, I forget exactly, but he asks, what are you waiting for, Christmas? Like he's in the police station. So he brings up Christmas, which is interesting. Like if we're supposed to be attuned and thinking about him as a Jewish character, why does he bring up Christmas?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something I'm like a huge bugaboo about, because one, I think Miguel Ferrer is great, and like in the Reflections book, and I'll talk more about this when we do like a real deep dive into Albert, but I mean, he loves the role, and you know, he thinks it's one of the best of his career. So on the one hand, like you're happy that like there's actors like getting like great roles of substance, but it is kind of like, you know, it's sad because it's like, you don't get him to see him be a Puerto Rican. And it's funny that you mentioned, actors playing, different ethnicities. His dad, Jose Ferrer, won an Oscar for playing Cyrano de Bergerac. And I believe he is still the only Latino man who has won the Best Actor Oscar Award. I think there's him, there's Rita Moreno, who won Best Supporting Actress for West Side Story. And there's, Benicio del Toro for Supporting Actor for Traffic. So, you know, just personally, it's just like, man, I'd love to see some more representation, but he's so great that it's like sort of, you know, on the one hand, I want more, but on the other, God, he's so good in this episode. And I guess sort of speaking of more about, you know, Truman and Albert, you know, there's a real big conflict that comes up between them, which I think is set up in the pilot where, you know, when Cooper and Truman first meet, they kind of pull each other aside and, you know, Cooper's like, hey, are we going to, you know, be butting heads on this? And Truman's like, no, I welcome your help, which I think really establishes that, hey, these guys are going to work together and be partners. And then when Albert comes in, you know, he's very, I think, East Coast pushy, to like use like a lack of a better phrase. And he's like, God, you know, this backwards Berg, you can't even do an autopsy right. And it clearly is like rankling Truman's feathers to no end. And and it's funny too, because Cooper the whole time is sort of like, he's like, you know, rubbing his hands together and giggling. And you're just like, I'm like, God, it seems so out of character for him to do that.
It's almost like he's watching a television show or something. Because he keeps looking yeah, for like for affirmation. Sure. Like, are you seeing this guy? Like, he's so entertained by it.
You know, so like that's, and we'll come back to that in just a second. But I also, in terms of like things that maybe haven't aged well, you know, Truman says to, you know, Albert, hey, if, you know, like if Cooper didn't vouch for you, I'm going to, you know, I'd kick your butt all the way down Queer Street or something like that, which of course is just like, horrible. You know, like, why do we have to use this like, you know, homophobic slur? And I mean, I guess, you know, now in the age of like, hey, when directors are going back and, you know, making changes and things like that, is that something that, you know, we should be changing, or should we leave it there and have the discussion? How do we feel about that aspect of sort of ugliness being brought out here?
I mean, there's so much that doesn't age well from right. the past. And, you know, I watch a lot of teen movies from the 1980s that have cringeworthy moments. And I don't feel,
you know, the other F word being thrown all over the place.
Yeah. And, you know, things that are downright racist. And so I'm not a fan of censorship, but I am a fan of conversation around these moments that are problematic.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but it's also very much in keeping with just the way people talked at the time, you know, and that's not to forgive it or say that it's okay. But I mean, it was just, it's funny to think just how much more common it was for people to just casually throw around that kind of language such a relatively short time ago, where now you would never hear that on a show on ABC or any other major network, and rightly so. And I think, you know, Jennifer, I think you're right on that. It invites a conversation that we still need to have as a society, and that it should be taken as an opportunity to have that conversation.
Within the context of this show and the character who says it, the way he says it, and everything that's going on, I wonder if it isn't a very intentional thing. I think of Lynch as a more open-minded, a more enlightened type of person. And I don't think that the word is used lightly, because I think this is Truman, literally Harry Truman, you know, the avatar of the 50s in this show, saying this hyper macho thing. It's even shot from above, where Truman kind of looms over Albert and, you know, and says he's going to knock his teeth two blocks down Queer Street. And it is, it actually seems out of character for Truman, but there is something about playing the tough guy and the use of this slur that seems like a brushstroke to me that fits with the rest of the theme of, you know, surfaces with this sort of dark violence underneath. Even Truman, who we understand to be a real, you know, a lawful good character, has this streak of homophobic violence underneath.
And I wonder if there's anti-Semitism in there too. Like he's belittling that comment. I you wonder if it's a combination of anti-Semitism and anti-gay. But back to Truman, there's a scene, or there's a part in the baseball scene that we talk, you know, where he says something about Andy that also feels super out of character, where he's joking that Andy.
Oh, he says, where there's no sense, there's no feeling. Yeah. He basically says, Andy, you're,
he got hit. He got hit in the head, but he'll be okay because he's got no sense.
Yeah. There's nothing
and,
there.
And he's super giddy when he makes that comment. And to me, those two moments were sort of these odd, out of character bits for Truman in this episode.
I mean, I think the thing to remember that is that even though while he's like a heroic character and he's likable in a lot of ways, he's also a small town cop 30 years ago.
Yep. Yeah. And I think, you know, like, and you know, when Albert, you know, is brought in, it's definitely, I think, you know, deliberate to sort of like, hey, you know, here's this city mouse coming into the country mouse territory. And I mean, they're going to butt heads. And I think, you know, going forward, watching, you know, particularly the Albert and Truman relationship is going to be really interesting, kind of how it like plays out and evolves as we, you know, keep watching the show. A couple more things I'm going to touch on in my section here, and you kind of alluded to it, Colin, is, you know, in terms of our Dungeons & Dragons character alignments, and if anyone listening is unfamiliar with, you know, D&D, it's a role-playing game where you select characters and they can be one of nine different alignments. In this case, I'd like to make an argument that what we've seen of Agent Cooper so far puts him in the neutral good alignment, which is sort of defined as basically a character that acts altruistically without regard for or against lawful precepts such as rules or tradition. A neutral good character has no problems cooperating with lawful officials, but does not feel beholden to them. In the event that doing the right thing requires the bending or breaking of rules, they do not suffer the same conflict that a truly good character would. And I definitely think that, you know, just based on like Cooper's openness to sort of, you know, his like Tibetan deductive technique, and even sort of like, you know, the giddy delight that he, you know, when he sees like two men who are clearly coming at things from like different ends, like Albert and Truman, you know, and just sort of his like, you know, he's smiling like it's like fun for him to watch. Like, you know, do we think he's neutral good, or do we think he's like maybe somewhere else? I know, Colin, you kind of wanted to push back on that a little bit.
Well, I don't have the definitions in front of me, but I was wondering if what we're gonna see from him pushes him into sort of that chaotic category. I think he's definitely good. You know, he has to be. Some of what we're gonna see in this episode shows that he can go to the dark side. He's open to it. And so I wonder if, you know, I think you're probably right on, because he'll bend the rules, but not break them. But I wanted to ask if you thought he stepped over into chaotic at all.
I mean, I don't think so, because a chaotic good character is sort of like a Robin Hood, right? Where you're like, you know, robbing from the rich and like stealing for the poor. But a lawful good is like someone who is, hey, the law says this and I should do this, and I should always behave like altruistically, and, you know, those sorts of things. So, you know, I think Cooper is definitely somewhere in the middle.
But that sounds right.
I think, you know, his character clearly is going to evolve, and like it'll be, you know, interesting to sort of keep track of where he's at on that spectrum. Last thing I wanted to discuss before we get into, you know, the money sequence here is we see a couple of dances in the show in this section. One, we see Audrey and, you know, kind of performing her famous, it's even called Audrey's Dance on the Badalamenti soundtrack. And then we also see Leland Palmer at his home. He puts on a record and he grabs Laura's picture and he's dancing to Transylvania 65,000. And it also kind of made me think of that scene in the pilot where they go to the high school and you see, you know, that totally random kid. And again, it was a random accident too that happened, right? Something that gets incorporated into the text of the show that wasn't planned. You know, the guy just kind of boogied down the hallway. And I remember in the pilot, we said sort of the cutaways to the blowing of the wind and that sort of stuff is almost sort of a signifier of, like, you know, the evil that men do, or sort of the evil presence that's lurking in the woods. You know, do we think that, you know, the dancing sort of connotates maybe people getting in touch with, like, that side of things, or maybe like a supernatural element, or even with Leland specifically, do we think it's maybe like his grief manifesting itself as madness? What do we think about the dancing, guys?
I mean, for Audrey, it definitely seems like she's going to a different place when she's dancing. She's definitely getting in touch with something, something that the rest of the characters in the show are not connecting with.
And she says, of course, if we haven't said already, she says, "God, I love this music. Isn't it too dreamy?"
And in an earlier sequence, it might not have been this episode, but she's playing music at the hotel and her dad's like, you know, "Turn off that racket." And like, it doesn't sound like racket. It's very beautiful, nostalgic music. So the interpretation of the sound is completely different depending on who you are.
I would agree, Jonathan, absolutely, that the dancing becomes sort of a ritualistic way into the other world, to go to the other world. And there are actual, you know, I mean, worldwide dance brings you, you know, cultures all over the world use dance to attain trance states and to tell stories from beyond. It makes us larger than our individual selves. And so I think there's absolutely something about it. And of course, with Leland, we see him, you know, spinning, and he starts spinning out of control, right? And the power of darkness that has captured that house pushes him until he shatters the picture of his daughter, and he's so far spun out on this evil that has touched them that he, you know, actually smears blood onto the photo. It's really a potent thing, and the dance is definitely a way that we show that. I think Lynch is showing people moving from one place to another. Audrey is so intrigued with the dark world and is trying to get closer and closer to it. So we see her going into a trance, which I think foretells some of what we're going to see from her as well.
Yeah. And not to step on like Damon's toes with the next section, but sort of like how the previous scene with the rocks and bottles set us up for something we're going to see in the dream sequence. I definitely think that, you know, seeing these couple of little dances here by Audrey and Leland is going to set us up for something we're going to see in the next scene of the episode.
This brings us to Cooper's dream sequence. And this is really my favorite scene in my favorite episode. This scene is great because, to me, this is where the show really jumps off into a new territory of television. You know, while previous episodes have brought us some strange twists and some really quirky and unusual characters and an innovative style, especially in the pilot, this is where we really kind of go off the deep end into something totally different from anything else that I think had ever been on TV before. And it just wouldn't be Twin Peaks. It wouldn't certainly be the Twin Peaks that we know, at least, without this scene. And what's amazing is that, you know, this wasn't even in the original script, this sequence. It's kind of a vision that Lynch had and added on pretty short notice. And, you know, in any other director's hands, I think this could easily have failed and probably would have. But Lynch just executes it so wonderfully. The scene is really effective, I think, in part because it uses some really simple elements like drapes and chairs and a statue and a lamp and a striped floor to create this space that feels so genuinely otherworldly. And then the backwards talking on top of that just really brings us into a domain that just feels totally alien. And I think part of why this hits so hard for me is because as a teenager, I was really obsessed with backmasking on rock and roll records, and I would play Beatles records backwards in the basement after school, looking for the secret messages. And I loved that because it felt like you were in on a secret. But there was also something that felt sort of vaguely sinister and disturbing about the sounds that came from those records. So I want to just make a couple of observations here about some things that that I picked up on my most recent rewatch of this, that a couple of them I hadn't really picked up on before. So other people may not have noticed either. The first of these is when the one-armed man, Mike, recites the Fire Walk With Me poem. Something that I noticed a couple nights ago when I was rewatching this is that the background behind him is the hospital morgue room where Laura was examined. And last episode, we saw Hawk lose track of him right outside of the morgue. So to me, that raises a question about sort of where this speech actually occurred in time. Like, this speech may have actually occurred right after Hawk lost him in the hospital last episode. And while we're on that subject, Bob also says some creepy things to us from some kind of boiler room or generator room. And I just want to sort of flag this as something for people to remember, and specifically the sort of weird ringing sound that we hear behind him, because we're going to hear this again or something very similar to it much, much, much further down the road from this. One thing that really strikes me about this dream sequence is that Coop is the only character who isn't speaking backwards. And that's interesting to me because it signals that he's a visitor in this strange domain, right? He's an outsider. So while the dancing man and his cousin, who looks just like Laura, both speak in this strange backwards way, Cooper, as an outsider, doesn't have that effect. But what's interesting is that the dancing man says that where we're from, the birds sing a pretty song and there's always music in the air. And what that implies to me is that he's not really from here either. This space is maybe a place that is between two worlds, as Mike says in the Fire Walk With Me poem. Another thing that really jumps out at me here is that Cooper's dream includes things that have happened previously in the narrative, but which he himself was not actually witness to. And in particular, in connection with Sarah Palmer. So we see her running down the stairs and calling Laura's name in slow motion. That's from the pilot. That's an event that actually happened, but Cooper wasn't there to see it, even though it's showing up in his dream. And then her vision of Bob. So this to me is how we know that what we're seeing here isn't just some weird dream. Coop is in fact really tapping into something deeper, which puts this rocks and bottles scene that we talked about a few minutes ago in a somewhat different context, right? Because it tells us that Cooper really does actually have an ability to tap into deeper truths through these sort of subconscious intuitive techniques. It's not just kind of nonsense. And Mike, the one-armed man, reinforces this when he says, "I mean it like it is, like it sounds." What he's telling us here to me is that these visions are not just to be taken seriously, they're to be taken somewhat literally. Coop really is connected to deeper truths through his dreams and visions. And that's interesting because, as we talked about earlier, Lynch himself believes that dreams and trances and meditation states are a meaningful way to get at deeper truths. And he frequently uses them to inspire his own artistic vision. So, you know, this brings us back around to the idea that was alluded to earlier, that Cooper is maybe a surrogate for Lynch himself in this show. So here's a question that's always struck me that I wanted to kind of throw out to the group. Mike, the one-armed man, in his narrative talks about seeing the face of God and then taking off his arm. And a lot has been written in criticism about Twin Peaks, about Laura as sort of a symbol of goodness and purity. And that's an idea that I want to explore more in future episodes. But what this raises to me is the question of whether the face of God was Laura Palmer. What do you all think about this face of God comment?
I don't know, but there's something that in this scene, I feel like Cooper has aged tremendously. Like his skin looks mm-hmm. different. So I feel like there's something there. Maybe he's been transported to the future. And I don't know if that takes on some religious connotation. Is this after death? I don't know. I hadn't really thought about the God part of it, but I definitely noticed that he was in a different state. He looked older.
Yeah, he's all wrinkly, right? He's got this red and black tie that matches the setting behind him, but we don't ever see him wear any other time in the show. And he's got more lapel pins, and it would be interesting to kind of zoom in on those and see what, if those signify something, you know, if they're government related or what, I don't know.
Right. It does seem like a far distant future of himself where he has, he has medals on his chest from the campaigns that he has been through. I saw that too and was wondering what those were. I couldn't make them out. The statue behind them in the Red Room is of Venus. And that sort of speaks to the, question of sensuality and carnal pleasure that is running through as well. But here it's, you know, frozen in a pure white statue. There's something very sort of Laura Palmer about that, right? If she is this force, she's been frozen in time by passing from life to death. When Mike says, I saw the face of God and I was changed, that was something that invites a lot of speculation, but it's hard for me to say what that actually, what it means. I wouldn't say I was picking up on Laura as the face of God, but it doesn't necessarily seem like a traditional pantheon here either. You know, if there are gods and things happening, they're not necessarily the gods we would expect to find at Doc Hayward's church that he's going to at 9 a.m.
I'll say, I don't really know how to answer your question, Damon, without spoiling, say, what happens in Twin Peaks The Return, but I definitely think that question is definitively answered within the context of the series, and in fact, right when it gets going. So maybe we, at least with me, we'll come back to that when we get down there. But I also think that, you know, you're right in the sense that, you know, what we're looking at here is maybe a waiting room, right? Or like a limbo, you know, there, you know, it's something where, you know, it's clearly not like a heaven or a hell, but maybe it's sort of like an in-between, or at least that's how I've always looked at the Red Room as. And I mean, even if you look at something like that came out a couple of years before this, like in Beetlejuice, right, where, you know, he goes to hell and he's not really there yet, but he's kind of in that waiting room where there's the, you know, where they all got like take a number and things like that. I definitely think that's part of what's going on here. It's like it's a place that gets you from maybe the physical realm to a different part of a spiritual realm.
Well, and one of you had mentioned to me previously that the floor is similar to the floor in Eraserhead. So I rewatched Eraserhead yesterday, and that floor is actually in the lobby. So that's kind of interesting to, if you're saying, if this is more of a waiting room, that the floor, if the floor was originally used in a lobby, kind of another hint.
The chairs are really similar to that Eraserhead set too. The other thing I wanted to touch on quickly in this is this Fire Walk With Me poem, right? Which is going to continue to be important throughout the rest of the series. But the line that has always struck me as ambiguous, and I've seen it written in two different ways, is one chance out between two worlds. And one could read that as C-H-A-N-C-E, as in you have one chance between the two worlds. But one could also read it as C-H-A-N-T-S. A person is chanting the phrase, fire walk with me, in a space between two worlds. And again, I've seen it written both ways, and I don't really know which one it is.
Could we look that up in the original script?
That's what I was wondering. But, you know, is the original script available to look at? I don't know.
Well, and if you watch the episode with subtitles, is that pulling from the script?
Right.
That could be a clue. But I love that it potentially has that double meaning, and perhaps that's intentional.
Sure. Anytime something is as juicy as that, it's probably intentionally meant to be taken either way or both.
I'm perfectly happy with it being ambiguous. I think it's better that it's ambiguous, that it could mean, you know, chance, like take a chance, and chance, like we're, you know, chanting. Yeah. And I think that's what's great about the scene, is that you don't necessarily have to have definitive answers for the scene to have, you know, lose any of its potency or its power or its ability to capture the imagination.
It's such a pleasurable scene because of all of those layers. And I think I watched it 3 times this week, because it's just, you're bombarded with so much. And that's the beauty of this, the artfulness of this episode, all those layers.
You say it's a pleasure, Jennifer, and I know what you mean. I also felt extreme eerie discomfort.
Oh yeah.
In the vibration of the man from another place, which is how he's credited in the script, the man from another place. Particularly when we first see him, his back is to us, and he's vibrating with that weird manic energy. That vibration is really disturbing to me for some reason. And I think it's a typical technique in horror. Like you'll see it in horror films and so on. But it was again not commonly used on ABC in 1990.
I mean, Damon and I are both huge DC comic book fans. And like when, you know, the man from the other place, Michael J. Anderson, like does the shaking, it totally reminded me of, and this is extremely nerdy, but like if you've read like Crisis on Infinite Earths, where like the Flash is like literally saying, I'm vibrating between worlds.
Right.
Man, I totally was like, he's just passing from one universe to the other, doing that vibrating. And like, it's a dance too. And of course we see him dancing. So, you know, I mean, I'm not saying it definitively answers the question of like the dancing on Twin Peaks, like coming from like an otherworldly place. But I think they're definitely like, Lynch wants you to make that connection, right? Like, and you know, the episode ends with he's like boogieing out to the credits, right? Which is different than the usual Laura Palmer face that we see. So, you know, I think it's, you know, more sort of visual clues to help interpret the mystery.
And then at the end, of course, the music, which is so great, follows Cooper out of the dream, right? He can still hear it in his head when he calls Truman. And even after he gets off the phone, he's still hearing that music. And something that struck me about that was how much that reminds me of some of my own dreams, where images or sounds kind of continue out of the dream. As I start to become aware of my surroundings, there's still like lingering traces that might stick with me for a few seconds. And so that felt really, really real to me.
Yes, as Audrey said, as Colin mentioned, isn't the music dreamy? So dreamy.
Can one of you guys give me a definitive meaning to the line, that gum you like is coming back in style? I really want to lock that down. You know,
I don't want to spoil nothing, but just that line is going to come back in a way that is so amazing. So just like that's a clue. All right. Like, and like when it shows up again, and the way that it shows up, you're just like, it's like literally like.
Well, it's interesting, right? Some of the things that might just be Lynch's deep intuition, odd things, seeds that he might have planted in the late 80s, he may or may not have known, and I'm sure we'll talk about this when we get to season three, he may or may not have known what where that was gonna go, but he's expert at leaving traces and circling back and tying things up. You know, whatever his process is, it exists in time, and there is always a connection, like a deepening, an iterative exploration, and going deeper.
We should also like make sure to credit Mark Frost here, because I definitely think that, like, while Lynch rightfully gets a lot of the credit for, you know, the dream sequence and he directed it and sort of stuff, I do think as the series goes along, a lot of the clues that are given here, Mark Frost really, I think, is the one that does a good job of like weaving those into the narrative, and kind of, you know, when we get some reveals, I think it's Frost that really kind of holds up that end and making him as powerful as it goes. Damon, if we're okay here, I do also want to mention that, like, this sequence was actually shot with the pilot, and and like in the credits you'll see that, like, Ron Garcia is like credited as cinematographer, so it's another one of the sort of the happy accidents, right, where they shot it for the pilot, you know, they put it in for, you know, the European version, but, you know, but then they really, like, they take this scene and bring it into the sort of the canonical narrative of the show, so it's another sort of one of those, you know, happy accidents that seems to happen all the time in the filming of Twin Peaks. It's also worth noting that the backwards dialogue is like, and you can watch this in any of the making of, but like Cheryl Lee, like, they're speaking the lines backwards phonetically, and then they're being played forward. So it's not like she's, you know, speaking the words backwards, she's saying the sounds backwards, and they're being played in reverse to make it seem like they're talking normal. So it's a really masterful piece of sound design.
That's part of how you get the unnatural motion too, because that right. footage is also backwards.
All right, folks, so we're gonna wrap things up here with our section called The Twist. And, you know, we said at the beginning that this is like a monumental episode of television, along with it being, you know, Damon's favorite episode of Twin Peaks. And I think one of the sort of ways you can see, like, just, you know, the power and influence of the scene is just how often it's been like parodied or, you know, shown up in like different forms of media. So if anybody wants to speak on, like, you know, do we think that's a sign of, like, when things have hit pop culture, or, you know, its peak is if they're sort of parodied, or the first thing somebody thinks of, or do we want to drop a few, you know, of our favorite parodies or things like that?
Well, there were a lot of parodies at the time when it came out that we can talk about, but it continues to be parodied today. And I'd already mentioned that an episode of Riverdale that aired in 2020 had an overt Twin Peaks theme. And they take it full on, where they have a video store that's called Blue Velvet Video, and it has this secret back room that is called the Scarlet Suite. Oh, that's awesome. And you go in, and it has a red glow, and it's full of just the most awful videos you can imagine, you know, snuff films, you know, home produced pornography. And it ends up being this portal, we start to find out in the new season that just began in 2021. That shop is a portal into this sort of underworld of behavior. So to me, that's super cool that all these decades later, the Red Room still resonates. So not only was it parodied at the time when it came out in all sorts of places, from Sesame Street to Saturday Night Live, but decades later, you see these homages, like on Riverdale.
I think too, when you look at, if anyone's seen like The Sopranos or Mad Men, which both of, you know, share a creator, you know, Matthew Weiner, like in The Sopranos, David Chase like writes in like weird, totally crazy dream sequences like into the narrative. And this is a show about like the mafia, right? And it's so funny because they had that mafia movie with Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro, where it's like Analyze This, where they're almost like making fun of, like, you know, like mafia guys getting fun, you know, getting in touch with like dreams and psychology, but yet, you know, in like maybe the definitive like mafia narrative, weird dream sequences are a huge part of like what's going on. So it's like, you know, what Lynch did here, I think made it okay for TV to be like, no, we're going to go into the subconscious.
I've got to talk about the Sesame Street parody, which Jennifer gave a shout out to, Twin Beaks. because I mean, to me, what that speaks to is that they know that the parents are watching Sesame Street with their kids, right? So they're putting the jokes in there for the parents that there's no way the kids are going to get. So if you haven't seen that, it's on YouTube, but David Finch, a bird, is having pie with another bird named Laura in a diner where all the birds mysteriously have two beaks. And it's just hilarious. The other one really jumped out that really jumped out to me, that I became aware of just a couple of years ago. I'm not a big video game guy, but there's this game called Deadly Premonition for the PlayStation 3, which is basically like a Twin Peaks game where they couldn't get the rights for Twin Peaks. There's like a lady who walks around with a pot that she's always talking to. And, you know, the lead character is this quirky out of town FBI agent. And on the walls in the hotel where he's staying, there's pictures of Snoqualmie Falls. It's just, there's a lot more shooting things that goes on, but it's basically an unauthorized Twin Peaks game. And it's kind of cool if you haven't seen that before.
When I was reading the comic book League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and that's a series where they take like historical figures and they, you know, tend to like solve a huge world crisis. But in those comics, there's these lengthy sections in the back where like Alan Moore kind of does a travelogue, and sure enough, they go to Twin Peaks, you know? So like, and he talks about like, you know, seeing some of the, you know, the spirits and things like that. So yeah, it's everywhere, man.
Well, Jennifer reminded me that it appeared in one of these pop culture tentpole episodes of The Simpsons. So The Simpsons ended one of their seasons with the big mystery of who shot Mr. Burns, which is a callback to who shot JR, which also echoes who killed Laura Palmer, which was one of the seminal pop culture moments. And the end of this episode is so great because Cooper actually says, "I know who killed Laura Palmer," and I'm watching, and I was back in 1990 wondering, oh my God, what's going to happen next? Who is it? How can they I just had that like pure Twin Peaks moment again. The show still has the power to, you know, spin me off into wondering what in the world is going to happen.
It's so funny too, because The Simpsons and Twin Peaks essentially debuted at like the exact same time. I think The Simpsons precedes it by a year, but it's funny because The Simpsons is still airing today and Twin Peaks obviously was, you know, cut short, right? But I mean, God, probably no more two influential shows from that time period than The Simpsons and Twin Peaks. So makes total sense to like do a parody that involves all kind of pop culture stuff.
Super, super groundbreaking. And in that Simpsons, I rewatched the Simpsons episode, and Sheriff Wiggins has some bad cream that's been sitting around, and he falls into basically a fever dream where he starts to kind of figure out, you know, what happened with the killing of Burns. So that's where he, you know, transports to the Red Room in his dream.
Well, that seems like a good place to leave it for this week. Thanks everyone for joining us for Back to the Double R. Thanks as always to Silencio for the music, and we'll see you next week.
Let's rock, everybody.